WHYY, we all know because of Terry Gross and Fresh Air. But Elizabeth Perez Luna is also there as the news director. Elizabeth, thank you for joining ThoughtCast.
You're welcome. I'm also in charge of some of the national programs, which is a very exciting combination of the national and the local. So that creates this, it avoids this separation between what's happening in a city and an area and what's happening at a national level. Because, you know, I mean, the old saying is local is global. I know it's a trite saying, but it's true.
I remember you from Crossroads days. Mm-hmm. How have you felt that public radio has evolved over the last several decades?
Well, evolved might be a difficult word to use. I think it has changed, but there were several things during the transition of public radio to what we are now, which is to bring the people who measured audiences, money, demographics, and all the measuring sticks that were used effectively, I think, by commercial radio, that were transferred to public radio without adapting it to that new, to what that new reality was of this animal called public broadcasting. That change, for example, it told stations that the more uniform and streamline your grid, your program grid, the more of an audience you would get, and audiences don't like fragmentation. And they also determined that half-hour programs do not work, hour programs are the ones. So you started to have the framework change, although there's always a framework, of course. We're not free-flowing radio, like the old community radio stations, which are the root of all we're doing now. So that became, with those systems, became also business models. You know, it limits the amount of risk you can take with programs themselves. And the bigger we became as in our responsibilities, as a lot of things, the more we felt responsible for every word and everything we did, because it had an impact. Sometimes that translates into uniforming the standards and translates into let's not offend anybody or let's follow these and other principles. I mean, there was a time when I worked a lot as an independent for NPR, and there was a time arbitrarily when I said we cannot start any piece with sound. Rules that were, of course it changed and all that, but were this need of systematize everything. Made us old and not looking for the risk that has made us important in the first place. This is a generalization, but I think there is a certain weariness of the voice of public radio, the pace of public radio, and sometimes we become a little bit too predictable, and then it becomes a little bit of a drone. Even shows as innovating as This American Life, as some of the terrific shows that have come out, Studio 360, Fresh Air itself, have a point in which they are almost repeating themselves in, not in the subject matter, but in the tone of doing things. So that's what we're talking about, change, innovation, not as a gratuitous thing, but also as a way of surviving as a vital entity.
At the moment, everybody is excited about the ways that new technology are allowing people to interact with each other, interact with the media, talk back to bloggers, do their own podcasts. And here's public radio serving or attempting to serve as sort of the master voice. Now, people at NPR are wondering, can they become more of a curator of public media rather than an emanator of public information? Do you think NPR is able to flex and grow and change and take risks in that way to stop being the one who delivers the information and start being the one who serves as the circus master, in a way, of the information?
I think you can be both, but at the core of every form of information is good writing, new ways of telling the stories, and good reporting, ethical approach to the news and to everything we do. So that should not change. The fact that there's a proliferation of blogs and all these other things doesn't mean that they're all of the same quality, that they all are accurate. So NPR and a lot of stations have this dual role. You can uphold these standards. You can desire that there's some changes, but it is a standard bearer. And so you need to continue that. And you need to also say how you translate that to new media, not only your new media, but create component and content for the new media exclusively. So that it's not, and I agree with a lot of my colleagues and say, using the web and blogs and all that, it should not be just a way of taking the same content and making it available in a different way. I don't think that's what people want the new media to do. I see new media as a way of taking some of the chances that we can't always do on the air. I like the new technology because of its immediacy, but I don't see it as kind of, it's either or. I really do think that we have to learn how to use new media in the way new media was designed for. And it is definitely not a repeater station.
Tell me if you agree with this, that there is a passion in the, if you want to call it, independent media, in the blogger or the podcaster or the citizen journalist that is not exhibited in a professional context where we have to worry about audio quality. Many podcasts do not sound like broadcast-worthy audio. That they don't care. Right. They're worried about getting what they want to say out there.
Yeah, quality of sound doesn't mean good content. I mean, yes, it's true we have a more sophisticated ear in general. What I'm interested in is using podcasting and all these new media as a way of becoming, you know, citizen in its complete thing, not only a political citizen, a cultural citizen, intergenerational, intercultural, explore areas that are in the ether but are not really talked about, like, you know, the complications of sexism and racism and how it's part of everything we do, and it's not like, that's why I object to ghettoized programming, and that's why we did Crossroads, which was not, and which was very popular and innovative. What I find a lot of in the new media, because it's very young and exciting, that there's a lot of material there that follows more into the confessional, the gossip, the debunking, unnecessarily, but within all that, there's a questioning of the system. You know, it's the equivalent of going and demonstrating in the streets. It becomes the plaza, the square, that place where we all discuss things and are open to things that we didn't know.
Can NPR become that place where dissent is voiced, encouraged, and rewarded?
I'm not sure, but I think because NPR feels and knows that it has a certain responsibility about what they say and what they do, and because it has so much power in terms of decision-making issues, and because the movers and shakers use NPR as their main source or as an important source for their decisions, I think it's not at NPR that these changes are going to happen. I think you find that, because I don't think that's their role, you know. But also I find something that I've had problems with public broadcasting, I find this confessional therapy type of programs, in which is me and I went to the cafe and, you know, there were blue flowers that day and that made me think of my grandmother who once had blue flowers. I find that self-indulgent, you know. I find that in our quest, in the quest for telling the real stories, quote unquote, I don't think radio should be a confessional place. And I think that's where perhaps the blogs and all that have a place. But I would, I'm more interested in other people's voices than, I don't think that every producer's life is that interesting, you know. Anyway, I think that all this energy and all that always starts with independence and then changes the culture from the outside.
And yet we're here at this conference and we're hearing, we must innovate, we must take risks. We've just listened to a session in which you were one of the panelists and you brought up this issue of media partnerships. Stations which form media partnerships are tied by these relationships and lose some of the elbow room they need. How do you take risks when this is the reality of your situation?
Well, you take risks by saying and by making it very clear that a partnership means automatically that we will not cover that event, that we will be independent in covering some of the aspects of what the organization does, but not necessarily, not if they are not newsworthy. For example, I do not accept any membership in anything, even advisory committee, panels, and I tell them very clearly that if I accept, it means that we can never cover it, which immediately there's a withdrawal of the offer, you know. The media partnerships are complicated because the implicit agreement between a media partnership, you know, media partnership with the Philadelphia Orchestra, media partnership with the Academy of Music or a museum or another nonprofit with the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania, is for me too close to becoming an agent and legitimize what they're doing when it's not necessarily true. You know, I think it might be because of my colleagues, I understand that it's a necessary evil. But I also believe that when you uphold very ethical standards and core values to the whole station, you have to understand how that is done and the consequences of that.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth Paris-Luna.
You're welcome. I appreciate it.
Long live independence.